For Antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas, I'm Scott Horton, and this is Antiwar Radio. Introducing the most successful libertarian author out there today, and with good reason, James Bovard. Welcome to the show, James.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me back on your program.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. And everybody, you can look up Jim Bovard's books and his blog at jimbovard.com. He writes for the Future Freedom Foundation and for the American Conservative Magazine. And check out this list of books going back into the early 1990s. The Farm Fiasco, Shakedown, The Fair Trade Fraud, Lost Rights, The Destruction of American Liberty, Freedom in Chains, Feeling Your Pain, The Explosion and Abuse of Government Power in the Clinton-Gore Years, Terrorism and Tyranny, Trampling Freedom, Justice, and Peace to Rid the World of Evil, The Bush Betrayal, and the masterpiece, Attention Deficit Democracy. And, Jim, I thought of Attention Deficit Democracy when I saw Keith Olbermann on TV the other night. We're actually running the video as our spotlight on antiwar.com today, where this is one of the things that apparently most people had overlooked in George Bush's speech, but he claimed credit for stopping four major terrorist plots since September 11th. And Olbermann went through and explained how they were all bogus. And in fact, two of them were the same plot being recycled twice. That was the supposed plot to attack the Library Tower in Los Angeles. And this Malaysian cell, this South Asian Al-Qaeda cell that George Bush broke up, which was the same one that had the fictitious plot for the Library Tower that was years old and never got beyond the imagination stage and was a big joke. And I just thought, isn't that funny? Because there's been, I don't know, at least a dozen or so high-profile terrorism prosecutions in the United States since September 11th. And here George Bush basically leaves out all of them, apparently tacitly admitting that almost all of these terrorist cases were bogus. And then the four he cites as being legit were bogus, too.
Well, and I'm glad Olbermann did that. I'm glad Antiwar is hyping that. But it is discouraging to see how easy it is for politicians to pull these rabbits out of their backside and wave them in the air, and people say, "Oh yeah, well thank God they're keeping us safe." You know, I'm always surprised at how gullible, you know. But it says something that would Keith Olbermann would be the person to blow the whistle on this, because you know he's doing great work, but it's not like he's got an investigative team working for him. The Washington Post didn't challenge this. The New York Times didn't challenge this. I don't think the Post challenges. The Post had an article on other Bush lies in the speech, but I was sitting there watching that Bush speech, and I'm just thinking, you know, it's almost interesting to try to keep track of the number of lies. I mean, there's lies, and then there's howlers, and then there's absurdities. And, you know, it's almost like trying to keep track of a baseball game where you're scoring each batter.
Right. It's just too much information. It's too high to count on both hands and both feet.
Well, and the sad thing is that partly because there's so much, you know, there's such a cloud of BS across the landscape that people simply shrug and many people simply defer. I think I read somewhere that that some poll showed that lots of people liked the speech. I mean, but that was the same thing we heard at the Clinton State of the Union addresses. I mean, I'm just surprised that people stayed awake for it, because Bush himself seemed like he's about ready to fall asleep in the first half of the speech, and Bush didn't get excited until he started talking about killing foreigners.
Well, and you know, if people are saying in the polls that they like the speech, it makes me wonder, what's their measure for whether they like it or not? You know, the pretty flag in the background, or does it have anything to do with the substance of what the president actually said?
The people that like that might be the kind of people who think that Dick Cheney looks dignified.
Yeah, that must be it. And, you know, I just thought, you know, here, I mean, literally, and if you watch the Olbermann thing, it's actually pretty funny. You know, he cites four, and as I said, two of them were the same one, and all of them were bogus. And yet, he made no mention of the Lodi, California case, the guys in Miami that were going to blow up the Sears Tower, the Virginia paintball guys who were told plead guilty or we'll turn you over to Don Rumsfeld, the Buffalo 6, the Lackawanna 6, the Detroit 5 who were convicted and then all set free, the plot against the New York and New Jersey banks. Remember that? The stormtroopers all over the street to protect the banks?
That was August 2004, just before the Democratic National Convention.
Yeah, coincidentally enough. And of course, that was the one where they burned the best Al-Qaeda guy they had ever caught. Pakistan had caught this Al-Qaeda guy. I forget his name. It's kind of hard to pronounce, but he was the computer wizard for Al-Qaeda, and he started sending out emails to all his Al-Qaeda guys saying, hey, come meet me in Karachi at the local coffee shop or whatever, and they were getting all these guys. And America decided, or I guess the Bush government decided, that they would burn this flipped informant in order to score points before John Kerry's big reporting for duty thing he did.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You were talking about the attention deficit theme, and there was one study by Cornell that showed that each time the government issued a terror attack warning after 9/11, the president's approval rating rose by roughly 3%. And 3% was basically the difference in the popular vote between Bush and Kerry.
Right.
It's fascinating to me to see how quickly people forget presidential lies. It's the same thing we saw with the Clinton administration, but you know, Bush on the campaign trail in 2004 was painting Iraq as a big success. He was doing the same thing this past September and October, and by amazing coincidence, just after the on the day after Election Day, Bush fired his defense secretary and admitted that things were kind of going to hell in a handbasket in Iraq. He wasn't quite that blunt, but I mean, Bush has told so many brazen lies about Iraq, and yet people still give him credence when he talks about Iran or other places. And, what does a politician have to do to ruin his credibility?
Right.
I shake my head ruefully.
And that is a major theme of the book, Attention Deficit Democracy. It's something I was thinking about, pondering, in preparing for this show, that, you know, basically everybody hates lawyers and politicians, right? Like, it's okay, even in mixed company, to tell a lawyer joke. Everybody hates lawyers. But once they become members of Congress or a president or an appointed staff member in the executive branch somewhere, down comes this giant cloak of legitimacy, that basically anything they do is, you know, wrapped in the flag and the Declaration of Independence and beyond question, even though these are the very same people that we all joke about what criminals they are among ourselves, you know?
Yeah, and I am mystified at the level of deference that's given to these folks. Even your two-bit member of the House of Representatives. I mean, if he goes someplace and makes a speech, people say, "Well, he's a member of Congress. He must know what he's talking about." I mean, many of these folks are still unable to find the men's room in the Capitol office buildings after being there for 10 years.
Yeah,
they are clueless.
Yeah, we saw the interview with the incoming head of the incoming Democratic head of the Intelligence Committee,
Jeff Stein.
Had no idea whatsoever about who's who, you know, whether Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda are the same thing or not, the difference between Sunni and Shia, anything at all. They asked him about Al-Qaeda. He said, I think they're mostly Shiites.
Yeah, Jeff Stein, I think, of Congressional Quarterly did that, and he interviewed a bunch of folks, and so many of them, you know, didn't know their backside from a hole in the ground.
Yeah.
And yet, these are the policymakers. The flip side on that, you know, it's interesting how much ignorance and, what's the word that would pass a libel test here? It's interesting how there's just so many different twists and turns in these things. The other candidate for the House Intelligence Committee, the other front runner, was Jane Harman, and the last I read on antiwar.com, the FBI was investigating the role of AIPAC in pushing her and keeping her on that House Intelligence Committee. I'm not, perhaps you've got an update on that. I don't know.
Yeah,
but
no, that was the last I heard of it.
Yeah, I mean, she's probably not as ignorant as the other guy. But if there's a foreign lobby that's pushing for her to be in that job, that certainly raises questions.
Yeah, it's some choice we have. You know, finally got rid of those dastardly Republicans, and now we have an agent of a foreign power versus a guy who has absolutely no idea, a guy who's been on the Intelligence Committee for years now and still has absolutely no idea the first detail of the various wars America's fighting right now.
Well, I mean, it's something which struck me in doing the research for the attention deficit for the book, was that the you know, people assume, you know, there is this myth of the best and the brightest in Washington. There is this notion that folks in Washington know a lot more than what they actually do, and that, you know, okay, it might, you know, Bush might seem like he's kind of dumb or uninformed, but, you know, but Bush has got these really smart advisors, people like Cheney.
Yeah.
And yet time, and, you know, this is something that I first was struck by this when I was doing the research for my first book, The Farm Fiasco. I went back and read and watched a lot of the floor debates in Congress about agriculture policy. And to see the things that the congressman would say, to see the things that the people on the agriculture committees would say, to see what the farm state congressman would say, I mean, they were either pathological liars or village idiots. Mm-hmm. Because there were just so many distortions and so many falsehoods, and you watch and see how they explain how these things work, and you're thinking, like, you know, it's just so deceptive. But part of that's due to ignorance. There was a funny case. The Friends of the Washington Times or whatever had a ceremony in one of the Senate office buildings in which Reverend Moon was crowned as a something, you know, where a crown was put on his head and he was recognized as the savior of humanity or something like that.
Right. I remember the pictures of that.
Yes, and there were and quite a few senators and congressmen showed up for the event. They just, you know, they basically didn't know what was going on, and they showed up and they're kind of like, well, strange that they're putting the crown on this guy's head, you know. But this is not out of the ordinary, because these folks are clueless for a lot of what they do every day. They don't bother reading most of the bills that they vote on. They don't care. They simply don't care. They have the power. They have the prestige. Case settled.
Right. Yeah, I guess when I was a kid, I sort of imagined, you know, if somebody's a senator, then, you know, they're up there not just doing for themselves, but they understand that, you know, they're writing history. They are in charge of the biggest decisions in the whole world, and they must take it seriously. There must be some gravity to their perception of what's going on. As you say, it's really shocking, kind of, to grow up and realize that even just the senators and the congressmen, even, they're just tall children. That's all they are. They're the same people we went to school with when we were in ninth grade, only now they're a little bit older.
Well, tall children, yeah, you know, let's just say, yeah, and many of them are having a very difficult puberty.
Yeah, afraid so. And, you know, this is something I really like about your book, too, is that as much as it is a criticism of the politicians and their lies and their wars and their torture and all that great stuff, which we'll get to later on in the interview, but it's an attack on American culture and American society and the individuals that make up the American population, that they don't care. They have no idea, you say in your book, they have no idea even who their congressman is. You know, can't name a single member of the Supreme Court. Don't have any idea. I think it was in your book where you mentioned that when people are asked which party is known as the liberal party and which is the conservative party, that people get them mixed up. The Republicans are the liberals and the Democrats are the conservatives.
Yeah, I mean, the number of know-nothing voters out there is much greater than the difference between winning and losing margins in most elections. And these are the folks who can be so easily swayed by waving the flag or pushing the patriotic buttons. It's fascinated me in recent years to talk to smart, gung-ho Bush supporters to try to understand how they reason, because some of these folks were very enthusiastic on this stuff, some of the stuff I wrote in the 1990s on Bill Clinton's lies and abuses. But since January 2001, they have just pretty much en masse gone over to the other side of the barricades. And to try to understand, okay, what are you basing this on? You know, why have you still got faith in George W. Bush after what's happened in Iraq, after what he's done to the Bill of Rights, after all the fiascos here at home? Well, you know, he's president, and Rush Limbaugh said, or Sean Hannity said, or we really have to keep an eye on those Muslims. I mean, it's fascinating how simple phrases like Islamo-fascist, a politician can throw that phrase out, and it's like he zaps the brains of 20% of the audience.
Sure, yeah, another favorite is, well, all the weapons are in Syria.
Oh, yeah, yes, I heard that from folks who I respect. Well, you know, they might be in Syria. And I'm thinking, like, you know, yeah, and they might be under my bed, too, you know.
Right. But, well, and, you know, it doesn't matter how many times you send them a link to Condoleezza Rice saying, no, no, I admit we have absolutely no evidence whatsoever that any of it was moved to Syria. You can send them that link, you know, 10 times, and they'll still insist.
Yeah, I mean, that's something, you know, I'm fascinated by how people reason about politics. Or, you know, or misreason, perhaps, is a more accurate term.
Mm-hmm.
To try to see the rules of evidence, the standards of evidence that people use when they're trying to pass judgment on their rulers. Because so often it's as if every bit of common sense they have gets flushed away before they start, thinking is, you know, in most cases, thinking is probably not the accurate word. Or just having a series of sentiments and feelings and reactions. Because if people would sit down and look and just kind of, okay, you know, think of this as building a brick wall. Here's a brick, here's a brick, here's a brick. They have to, you know, the bricks have to be in the right order or the wall is going to collapse. But people don't do that. Most people don't do that when they're thinking about government.
Right. For some reason, and I don't know what it is. What is it, James? What's the reason that it's just different? If I come to you and tell you a magnificent story, you're going to hold me to a standard of evidence of, you know, first of all, if what I say, does it sound credible in the first place? You know, is it plausible that I was where I say I was? Whatever. You're gonna try to figure out whether I'm telling the truth or not. Why is it that when it's government talking that people just turn all that off?
Well, you know, and to take your analogy one step further, it's not just you're telling me a story. It's you're telling me a story and you're taking $500 from my bank account.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, and spending it killing somebody.
Yes, yes, and you know, I don't know. I mean,
book you call it battered citizen syndrome.
Yes.
We're all like a bunch of beaten wives.
Well, that's how many people are. So, you know, something which I tried to make clear is that people talk. There's an old saying that people get the government that they deserve, and I think that's a slander because, you know, you and I don't deserve George Bush. People who have been kept informed, and people who have spoken out, people who have done what they could, don't deserve to be dragged into one war after another and have their rights and liberties shredded time after again with these bogus cases and these false claims by the government. There are a lot of Americans who have spoken out, who have gotten informed and tried their best to curb Leviathan. These folks don't deserve to be trampled.
Yeah, it's true enough, I guess, that as long as enough of our neighbors deserve the government they get, that we're in for it too.
Joint and several liability. I think that's a legal term. Yeah. Well, and it's frustrating to try to, you know, it's something which it struck me in the years just after 9/11, dealing with newspaper editors. They were so frightened. They were so deferential, and there was just almost like there was this unspoken dread at times publishing criticism that went too far, and too far was, you know, wasn't really clear what it was, but you weren't really supposed to say the president had lied. But if you can't say that the president lied, that makes it too easy for him to grab more power.
Right. And that's something that, you know, as I'm sitting here reviewing your book last night, going back through, taking notes and such, I was reminded of just the level, the atmosphere of impunity that surrounded Bush and his administration in the first at least couple of years.
That is a great phrase, Scott. Atmosphere of impunity. Great phrase.
Yeah, well, thank you. And that is really what it was, right? James Bovard takes his great book to the publisher and says, check out this great book. It's as well footnoted as any book I've ever written. See what you think. And they go, oh, James, you call the president a liar. Well, I don't know if we want to go that far.
Well, actually, with Palgrave St. Martin's Press for Terrorism and Tyranny, which came out in 2003... Palgrave was very stalwart on that. My editors there at that time never flinched. They were great. I mean, newspaper editors, magazine editors, that was a different story.
Yeah.
But Palgrave St. Martin's was good at that time. So, but by and large, I mean, you know, just seeing what was published and seeing, you know, just almost the shakiness of some editors who had been very good in the past. It's just like, you know, guys, what's the problem? He's lying. Can't you see it? Well, you know.
Well, and hell, you know, the same publishers can look out the window and see the protesters being corralled into a free speech zone. The fact that they got away with that more than once, I think, ought to just speak volumes about what's happened to our country, our way of life.
I agree. And it was, I guess I first wrote about free speech zones for American Conservative in late 2003, early 2004. You know, you see the brazenness of the abuses, of so many of the abuses. It's the same thing that we've seen over the last year and a half with the Bush claims about the wiretapping, with the, you know, that the president has authority himself to order wiretaps. And this is so completely contrary to the Constitution, to the Fourth Amendment, to federal law. And yet, you know, it doesn't matter how much power Bush grabs, he'll always have a bunch of intellectuals to come trolling behind him saying, it's his right, it's his power, you know, it's important for the president to have absolute power or else we'll all be killed.
Right. And as you say, this is nothing in the Constitution. And James Madison and even Alexander Hamilton and evil people like that, they knew that when they were creating this government that the future would hold, you know, tests and turmoil and danger. But they still didn't say, okay, well, when times are really tough, the president becomes the king. It still doesn't say that, you know?
Well, yeah, and, you know, a king is not enough for these folks. It's czar.
Yeah.
You know, because most of the kings had limits on their power most of the time in history, most of the time in modern history. But with the, you know, there, and I was surprised it was in, I believe, in late June 2004 that the memos came out of the, leaked out from the Justice Department and from the White House, that from 2002, that on the torture, on interrogation standards, that said that the president is above the law during wartime, that the president's power is not constrained by any criminal law. And it was clear at that point that the Bush team was claiming absolute power, claiming a right to violate the Constitution or the laws whenever it pleased. And there was very little controversy about that at that point. That's 2.5 years later. And some people are saying, well, maybe the president got too much power. But John Yoo is still being treated as a hero at the Washington think tanks and still getting very favorable treatment in much of the nation's media.
Yeah. If it's okay, Jim, I'd like to read a little bit from one of those memos. This is from page 115 of your book, Attention Deficit Democracy. And this is from the Justice Department memo about what happens if you intentionally kill someone while you're torturing them.
Good choice.
It says, the necessity defense may prove essentially relevant in the current circumstances. First, the defense is not limited to certain types of harms. Therefore, the harm inflicted by necessity may include intentional homicide, so long as the harm avoided is greater, i.e., preventing more deaths. Second, it must be actually the defendant's intention to avoid the greater harm. Third, if the defendant reasonably believed that the lesser harm was necessary, even if unknown to him it was not, he may still avail himself of the defense. Clearly, any harm that might occur during an interrogation would pale to insignificance compared to the harm avoided by preventing such an attack, which could take hundreds or thousands of lives. So, I guess, you know, if I can be Cheney's advocate here, it's not going to sound very convincing, Jim, but you know, they asked...
Well, it might be better than Scooter Libby today.
Yeah, well, if it's not better than that, then, you know, I have no business doing this. But, you know, Hillary Clinton, she was asked, well, you're against torture, right? And she said, oh, yeah, I'm against torture. And they said, well, what if it's an emergency? She said, well, if it's an emergency, then, yeah, you got to torture the guy. And, so, you know, I guess this is the case that they're making in the memo here, that if a CIA agent, say, I don't know, Kiefer Sutherland, believes that without torturing someone, an atomic bomb is going to go off and, you know, destroy all of New York City or something, then isn't it okay at that point to avoid the greater harm to go ahead and torture someone? Why shouldn't the president or, you know, his subordinates be able to save our lives that way?
Well, it's interesting that the advocates of torture, thanks for quoting from that memo. I mean, that memo was a torturer's emancipation proclamation. It was a statement by the Justice Department and, you know, accepted by the White House that basically said that U.S. agents can kill during interrogations, and that's happened a number of times We have no idea how often that's happened, but even if they kill during an interrogation, they're almost never guilty of murder because they were killing with good intentions. That's what this memo means.
Yeah, basically says before the fact, we're pretty sure that if you killed this guy that you had a good reason to do it or you wouldn't have killed him, right?
Right. I mean, this ticking time bomb scenario, which they always flourish when they're trying to sanctify acting like barbarians, I am not aware of any ticking time bomb scenarios that have actually been tied into the U.S. Interrogations. The government has set off so many false alarms. The government itself doesn't know what it's doing. And if you're talking about saving lives from torture, you might want to factor in the 600,000 or 700,000 people who have been killed, according to some estimates, in Iraq, because the U.S. Bush justified invading Iraq in part based on so-called information that was gained by torture from a detainee in, was that Egypt?
Right, yeah, Al Libi, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, and Saddam Hussein taught us how to hijack planes.
Yep, and so that was, so we talk about torture saving lives, well, except for the 3,000 American soldiers that have died in Iraq and the hundreds of thousands of Iraqis have been killed, but people forget that.
You wrote on the anti-war blog recently that that's even the DIA study proved that there is no good reason to torture someone other than getting the lies that you want out of them.
Yeah, well, I don't know that the DEI, the Defense Intelligence Agency came out and said that. I was quoting Juan Cole, who's done some great work there as well.
Well, and, yeah, I was being facetious. What they said was they couldn't figure out a way to measure whether they were getting truth out of anybody with it or not, basically.
Yeah, and, you know,
it's good for what they claim it's good for.
Yeah, and it's worthwhile to keep in mind some of the interrogation practices which the U.S. has adopted in recent years. They have been influenced by the Israeli practices. Israel's been dealing with, shall we say, rough interrogation for a long time, and there have been times where they've said that they've stopped, and it's really been unclear that they did. But there have been some wonderful anti-torture and human rights activists in Israel who have looked into this and exposed it. And there was a quote from one of them. She said that the torture time, ticking time bomb scenario, you know, we hear about that all the time, but there's no documented case that's ever been valid in Israel for Israeli interrogation practices. But she did point out that, you know, that the torture starts by talking about preventing bombs from going off, and it migrates, and pretty soon they were torturing teenage boys to make them confess to throwing rocks.
Yeah.
And Lord, you know, there have been a number of the fatalities that have occurred from U.S. interrogation where people who were innocent, like there was an Iraqi general who was turned himself in, and he was beaten to death and basically strangled by American troops in Iraq in late 2003 with something that they call the sleeping bag method.
The sleeping bag method, what's that?
The sleeping bag method was... it came to light in a trial in 2005 out in Colorado, Fort Collins, I think it was. This is the case of an Iraqi general who was stuffed upside down in a sleeping bag. He was bound in wire, and a U.S. warrant officer sat on his chest and covered his mouth. Surprise, surprise, he died.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't really clear if that's what killed him, because he'd been beaten very severely by soldiers for the NCIA people, apparently, in the days prior to his death.
Oh, so many different people beat him, it's hard to charge any one of them with his murder, is that it?
Yeah, there was a chief warrant officer who was charged. I don't know if he was charged with murder, but he was basically found guilty in a military court-martial, and he was sentenced to home confinement for, you know, 6 months until he qualified for his 20-year pension.
Yeah. Well, that's a reasonable charge for homicide as long as the person committing it is a government employee, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, I just don't think that if someone kidnapped a staff member from Vice President Cheney's office and tied them up and beat them and covered their mouth and stuff like that, even if the person didn't die, I would think that the person that captured them and tortured them would get more than 6 months home confinement.
Yeah, perhaps life in prison.
Well, yeah, if they survive the arrest.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, you know, on this torture story, you wrote it recently in the American Conservative magazine that this is actually really still holds the most potential for actually removing the criminal Bush-Cheney regime from power before 2009, that there are torture memos that I guess we haven't seen yet, but we know exist, that have George Bush's signature on them that say, go ahead and torture people in violation of the law. You make the comparison that this would be like having Richard Nixon's fingerprints and signature on instructions for the Watergate burglaries.
Yeah, that's thanks for bringing that up. This is something that the Bush has apparently issued a secret executive order in which he gave his personal approval on setting up these detention facilities outside the U.S. and outlining interrogation methods that could be used against detainees, and there was an email from the FBI's on-scene commander in Baghdad in May 2004 in which he was objecting to some of the brutality being used by the U.S. military against detainees, and U.S. Military officials assured him there was a secret presidential executive order that permitted extreme interrogation methods such as use of hoods, stress positions, military dogs, etc. And this apparently comes directly from George W. Bush. If this does hit the streets, it might be like if there had been a 1972 memo from Richard Nixon that talked about the exact methods of lockpicking the Watergate burglars should use. Bush's involvement in the torture scandal could be a lot deeper than Nixon's involvement in Watergate.
Well, does it matter that Congress has retroactively legalized any act of torture committed by the government since 1997?
This is the rule of law in America in the new century. Retroactive decriminalization of torture. You know, doesn't this make you proud to be an American, you know?
Yes, in fact, my flag is at half-staff.
I assume that's because of Gerald Ford.
Yeah, I'm still really upset over that.
Yeah, well, you know,
the loss of the Pharaoh.
Yeah, I've certainly struggled with that as well. You know, it was fascinating to watch last September and October how this Military Commissions Act went down, because in some ways it epitomized how American democracy is becoming a farce, because there was not any need to rush this bill through. But the GOP chose to push this bill as part of their congressional reelection campaign, and
that ought to tell you something right there. The fact that they run on the Patriot Act, they run on spying on you, and they accuse anyone who refuses to spy on you and uphold the Patriot Act as being soft on terrorists.
And they ask me why I drink.
Yeah,
you know, yeah, it was fascinating to see how the GOP tried to play this. As soon as they had those bills out there, well, Bush was going around the country last October, and in victory rallies for GOP candidates, he was claiming that the Democrats were opposed to any questioning of terrorists, and this is, I mean, you know, Bush was implying that if somebody was not in favor of torture, they were not in favor of questioning. I have known some tough questioners in my time, but I mean, this, you know, they didn't need to use torture. But it was so profoundly dishonest, and yet Bush got away with it. There was very little fundamental objection to Bush's methods. And after Bush came out on the day after the congressional election and said it was important to put the election behind us. Yeah, well, Bush tried to, you know, stab the Democrats and smear them in the back and destroy them that way. He failed, and now he's saying, well, let's be friends. Why would anybody trust George Bush after all his lies on torture, on terrorism, on Iraq? I mean, why does this guy have any credibility to even show up at a press conference?
Yeah, well, and the same thing goes in the media, too. It sort of is, I guess, a kind of an unsaid rule in the newspaper business that the only credible pundit is the pundit who was for the war in Iraq.
Yeah, there was a very nice piece that antiwar.com linked to recently that profiled what's happened to the pro-war media folks and the anti-war media folks, and let's just say there's six-figure differences there.
Right. Yeah, Bill Kristol just got hired at Time Magazine, a guy who's been wrong about everything.
Well, the you know, it might be that the key is that they show respect for government, for the politicians, for authority, and in order to be taken seriously in Washington, you must defer to the government.
Mm-hmm.
And
which is why Thomas Friedman is such a celebrated pundit to this day. I guess.
You know, Friedman's an interesting case. Friedman did some great work in the early 80s when he was over in Lebanon.
Yeah, that was a long time ago, Jim.
I agree. Friedman did some great writing about the massacre in the Palestinian refugee camps by the proxies of the Israeli Defense Force. As you said, that's more than a quarter century ago, almost a quarter century ago.
Yeah, and now on this torture thing, one more thing I want to say. You point out in your book that the American people just refuse to put the shoe on the other foot. And you bring up the case of Jessica Lynch, the big PR stunt about, you know, this woman who fought off a whole company of Iraqis like Rambo until her gun finally jammed and they capture. But you say, what if that cute little cupcake, that little Jessica Lynch, what if...
I didn't call her a cupcake.
Oh, that's just me.
But
what if she...
You know,
she...
I hate to get the feminists angry at me for that, you know?
Oh, yeah, I don't want you getting in trouble with the feminists. I can take it.
Hey, the first time.
I know, you're a fragile soul, man. But no, you say, what if it had been pictures of Jessica Lynch with a bag over her head chained up with dogs attacking her? What if it had been pictures of Jessica Lynch, you know, standing on a box in a Jesus pose with electrodes attached to her parts? You know, what would have been the reaction of the American people? Think how upset people got just from the phony story that she got taken captive at all.
Yeah, and one other example, how would Americans have reacted if they had seen videos of Jessica Lynch screaming as she was being assaulted and beaten by her Iraqi captors? I mean, thank goodness she was not treated that way by the Iraqis. From what I read, she was treated in a very decent way, far better than the Americans have treated many of the Iraqi detainees.
Mm-hmm.
But just, you know, I was trying to find a way to get that flash in front of the reader's eyes to make them realize, okay, this is what we've done. How would we react if they did this to an American, you know, to someone who was, you know, 20 years old, blonde, blue-eyed, very attractive, from West Virginia, but still, you know, a fine lady.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess... that should be a powerful analogy. What do you think, audience? Does that make you think, geez, wow. I guess if it had been Jessica Lynch being tortured at Abu Ghraib, I would feel pretty upset about that. Maybe not. I don't know. Maybe it's just a bridge too far to ask people to put themselves in somebody else's shoes.
Well, you know, it certainly raised eyebrow with the copy editor.
Oh, good. They noticed at least.
Well, are you sure you want to say this, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, is this too inflammatory? I said, you know... If I haven't lost readers by this point in the book, you know, what the heck, let's go with it.
Yeah, I liked it. I thought it was a good one. And again, like, this goes to your larger point, which is that the government at this point, the Constitution and, you know, James Madison and all those quaint old traditions aside, is above the law, they're above the truth, they can do whatever they want, they're the most powerful empire in the history of humanity.
Yeah, and I'm fascinated by this question of rule of law. Bush invokes this every now and then, especially when he's talking about foreign countries. But what we have in this country is the rule of whatever the president says is law. You have George Bush with these 700 or 800 signing statements announcing that he will not obey this provision in the law or that provision in the law. Who knows how many other laws that he has decided to nullify. You have a president surrounded by people who assure him that his power is absolute. And George Bush doesn't have the reading habits that would lead him to think otherwise. Things are out of control at so many levels in the federal government, and here we are tottering on the verge of launching a war against Iran, which very few people in this country want. And yet we are acting like he's the president. You know, he can start a war if he wants to, if he thinks it's best. I mean, this, you know, the danger of war with Iran epitomizes the Americans' loss of control over the federal government.
Indeed, yeah, and they talk about it the way they talk about it on TV now that they'll finally even admit that there's such a topic as an impending war against Iran. that's really what they're talking about is, well, gee, can the Congress do anything about it? I guess not, huh? He really is the commander-in-chief, which, on the war question aside for a moment, and I'd like to get back to the impending war against Iran in a moment, but
sure.
to the larger theory here that the president, you know, is the commander-in-chief of all of us, that he's this unitary executive leader who has, you know, all this power, as you say, you know, his little sycophants that follow him around telling him that everything he's doing here is legal. What's the history of this? Where does this unitary executive theory come from? Is this the kind of thing that dates back to John Adams and Alexander Hamilton, or is this something that some ex-Trotskyites made up in the 1990s, or what?
You know, it sounds like it's more from Thomas Hobbes than from Alexander Hamilton. There is, or even some of the theorists of absolute power that were even more extreme,
Rousseau,
and darker than Hobbes. It, you know, first of all, it's absurd as far as the history of the interpretation of the U.S. Constitution. I mean, it does not have any credible support, and it is a theory which just completely ignores any limits on government power. It is, you know, it is a theory that practically implies that Americans have a choice of being serfs of some supreme leader or of being destroyed by foreign enemies, and you know neither is the case. That you know that's not the choice. But to see the caliber of intellectual arguments being made for this this doctrine of presidential supremacy, it is pathetic. And yet, simply because the government has so much power, because the media is so deferential, people treat these claims with deference, and so it's just like, you know, what in the hell are people doing that they can't recognize that this is so profoundly anti-democratic? It's a travesty of the republic, and it is the death of American liberty. And we put this guy on a pedestal and saying that he has a right to say what the law is, and he doesn't have to tell us what the law is until after he decides to punish us.
Right, and of course, all the most powerful leaders of the opposition in the Imperial Senate are all running for president and all want this power for themselves. So they're not going to do the slightest thing, even though they now control the Congress. They're not going to try to limit this power.
I don't know. I think some of them might, basically for their own political advantage, partly because that's what voters are signaling that they want. But as far as the fundamental examination of of Bush's power grabs, I don't see it happening. It's the same frustration which I felt in 2001 when Clinton left office and the Bush White House team basically said that they were going to keep the files closed on Clinton's abuses. I would think that there may have been evidence in the Pardongate scandals and Clinton's auctioning off of pardons at the end of his presidency in the last few days.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were a lot of things there that begged for sunlight. But the Bush team in 2001 basically decided to keep everything behind the wizard's curtain, and thereby preserve the power and the prestige of the presidency.
Well, it's because Bush is a uniter, not a divider.
Well, tell that to the Iraqis.
Yeah, the ones who haven't been divided from their bodies.
Yeah, well, or sent to heaven yet.
Yeah. Divided from their family members. All right, now, to the war in Iran, I just want to get this off my chest. Sorry for, you know, taking up a piece of your interview to do it, and you say whatever you like when I'm done. But Iran can't make a nuclear weapon, and everybody in the world knows it, and the International Institute for Strategic Studies in Great Britain just came out yesterday with a new study saying so. John Negroponte said somewhere between 5 or 10 years, more like 10, what they have is a few dozen centrifuges that barely work in a laboratory environment. If they can enrich uranium, the little bit they can enrich it to 3.6%, which you cannot make a bomb out of. They've got International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors at every nuclear facility in Iran safeguarding every bit of this, and here we are again marching to war on the purest of lies. I mean, the evidence against Iran, the evidence that Iran has a nuclear weapons program, as though the existence of one would be a good enough reason for war in the first place. Let's just take that for granted for argument's sake. The evidence that they have a nuclear weapons program is zero. It's nothing. And yet we're on the eve of war to preempt it.
Well, Scott, it's important to see the big picture. And the big picture is that the president, or I forgot what, supreme leader of Iran, he's made some statements in public that justify killing all the Iranians.
Oh, I see. And so is it okay to go ahead and start taking bets now as to whether Ahmadinejad himself is going to be killed in these impending airstrikes?
Well, you know, maybe the Bush team would give him a fair trial first, just like they did with Saddam.
Yeah. Well, and see, that's another thing, too, that is driving me crazy, is here this guy, Ahmadinejad, says some, you know, pretty inflammatory things, but all the, you know, world press, anyway, I don't know if the American press has picked up on this at all, but if you read the foreign papers, it's pretty clear that the Ayatollah Khamenei, who is the true leader of Iran, has been telling this guy, Ahmadinejad, to shut his mouth. Because he doesn't want war with the United States, and he's even willing to compromise and negotiate and suspend the enrichment that they're guaranteed the right to under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The Khamenei is trying to trying to thwart the war.
Yeah, Scott, I agree with you 100% on the danger of war. I'm absolutely opposed to the U.S. attacking Iran or provoking attacks, or somehow, you know, sneaking some provocation in for which the U.S. can claim justifies war. This would be the worst possible thing that could happen short term in this country. It'd make it far more difficult to get Americans to think clearly about their rulers, about government, about power, and to get Americans to think about who the real threats to their liberties are. Because this, you know, I saw this in 2003. There were a lot of people who I knew that once the war against Iraq started, it was as if their IQs dropped 20 points. And you sit and you try and reason with them, and there were people who 6 months earlier could understand things and had a good recall of history. And it was like that the war zapped a large part of their intelligence. And it would be a travesty if we attack Iran. And if George Bush does this, he should be held legally responsible in a way that, you know, Nixon, Johnson, and other presidents should have been held legally responsible for the crimes and lies of the Vietnam War.
Yeah, well, and of course, if anybody in the House of Representatives was serious, or okay, if Nancy Pelosi was serious about trying to stop this, then she could have the House Judiciary Committee hand down articles of impeachment tomorrow. And, you know, no president, I don't care if his approval ratings is in the 20s, he can get away with it. No president can start a war in the middle of impeachment proceedings. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. Clinton bombed Iraq, Operation Desert Fox, right in the middle of impeachment proceedings, didn't he? Well, still, they could attempt to thwart him by, you know, issuing articles of impeachment against Bush and Cheney tomorrow. If they wanted to stop him, they could do that. Well, or they could support Walter Jones and his resolution, which says you absolutely may not bomb Iran unless you come to us first.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, a huge problem here is that Bush, Cheney, and their top advisors have no fear of legal consequences. These folks feel that that being in that office gives them a license to kill. It's the same way that Bill Clinton and his team felt about dropping bombs on Belgrade. They had a license to kill Serbians and people at the Chinese embassy simply because Bill Clinton made certain statements about the situation in Kosovo. Therefore, those killings were sanctified and nobody could touch them legally. It's the same trouble. I mean, the rule of law is invalid if some people have the right to kill with no legal consequence. And that's what we have in this country right now, especially as far as foreign policy. We have it's a trouble that occurs here at home as well at times, but it's far clearer abroad that these folks think that they have the right to, you know, basically kill an X number of people in a foreign country simply to make a statement.
Right. And again, it's always based on lies, whether it's the pretend mass graves of the genocide of Kosovo or the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq or now Bush's accusation is, I guess we're not supposed to really break it down and we'll see how ridiculous it is, but supposedly, I guess, the Iranians are backing the Sunni insurgency in Iraq.
Well, I mean, you know, this is a good example, and it is frustrating to me because the Bush team has made so many false claims about Iraq, and they're adding new dubious or false claims about the Iranians week by week. and doing everything that they can to ratchet up the tension. And yet, each, you know, there is still the 24-hour or 48-hour window of opportunity in which people simply take the latest accusation on faith. Oh, that's what the Iranians have done. Oh, that's what they've done. And people don't realize that the charge either falls apart or is often retracted.
Yeah, you call this an attention deficit democracy. You say this is the right to lie for 72 hours.
Yes, I mean, this is something which came up in the 2004 presidential campaign. I think it was the New York Times started doing articles on the same day or the following day of a Bush speech pointing out the president's falsehoods. And the White House was outraged and felt like that was a violation of the president's prerogatives. So basically, it appears that the White House thinks that the president has a right to lie long enough until it's too late to stop him.
Right. Or, you know, as my friend Shauna points out, long ago she pointed out that as long as you believe they're lie for today or tomorrow, and that's long enough to actually get done whatever it is they're trying to get done, it really doesn't matter once they're caught. They really don't mind being called out for being a liar. They just kind of shrug and say, okay, yeah, I lied to you. But it doesn't matter because you bought it long enough for, I don't know, for me to bomb Iran, I guess, in this case.
Yeah, I mean, to put this in somewhat crude terms, it's the same as someone who would lie to score in a one-night stand. Well, the next day you find out that he lied, and or he or she lied, and find out it was all bogus, but, you know, it's kind of hard to, turn back the page.
Yeah.
Or turn back the sheet.
Now, something that you talk about in here in the book, Attention Deficit Democracy, Jim, is American exceptionalism. And you kind of attack the idea that America's so special that it's all just going to work out in the end, and so we don't really need to pay attention. But I kind of want to take a different riff off of that, I guess, which is that really America is exceptional from the Declaration of Independence through really our whole history and the highest standard of living ever, and economic liberty for the average guy to be able to make good if he works hard and saves up and that sort of thing. Really, America is exceptional. The problem is then we go trying to cram our exceptionalism down everybody's throat, and we ruin what's good about our country in the first place by trying to make everyone else adopt our way of life.
Well, there's a lot of truth to that. There is something. The Declaration of Independence was a magnificent statement of moral principle, and it was great that so many people had a clear understanding back then of the perils of political power. It was great that Americans had the courage to shake off a king and an entire government and to try to build something new that would have far less power to ruin their lives. Obviously, it hasn't gone as well as the Founding Fathers hoped at times, but there have been a lot of people, and there have even been some good politicians who have stood up for those principles that the Revolutionary Army fought for back in the 1770s. As far as trying to spread this abroad, so often it's a complete fraud when the U.S. says it's trying to bring democracy or liberty to a foreign country. It's just trying to put in some U.S.-approved leader or some U.S.-approved hack. It surprised me that I've been shocked at how Bush has been able to sell his so-called war on terror with the paradigm of the terrorists hate freedom, and that's why we have to have the power to crush terrorists. Most of the terrorists don't give a darn about freedom, and most of the terrorists pose no threat to American freedom. But Bush has been able to sell this as a crusade for freedom when it was just so completely bogus. And yet, even still, with his State of the Union address a few weeks ago, this was a big theme of his, those terrorists hate freedom, so we need more power to crush them. It seems like it should be a laugh line from some Saturday Night Live parody of presidential rhetoric, and yet it's out there, it's still being used, and it's still working.
You know, I'm reminded of your review of Richard Perle's book, An End to Evil. And how thin his argument is for, you know, going around the world killing everybody in the name of freedom. And I thought, well, maybe the reason his argument is so thin is because rather than being an ideologue, what he really is a Lockheed lobbyist who's just trying to make some money.
Well, I don't know if that's the case with... I don't know if that's the primary motivation with Richard Perle. I mean, you know, Perle has had a very casual attitude towards the facts for a long time. But there is a sanctimonious about Perle which is extreme even by neoconservative standards. And yet, you know, and yet he's still treated respectfully by the media. I mean, he's still given, you know, very visible news hall for his commentaries. And I'm thinking, this guy has admitted so many things that you would think would disqualify him. But the same is true of Kissinger.
Yeah, well, he's the Prince of Darkness, and the media knows where their loyalties lie.
Yeah, you know, some days I totter in the edge of cynicism.
Yeah. Oh, man. I was thinking, it's sort of like where the frog in the boiling pot, or, you know, the old analogy about if you turn up the heat too fast, the frog will jump out, but if you turn it up slow, he'll go ahead and jump. And I'm looking at where we are now, and I'm trying to figure out where in the analogy. It seems like the heat is getting turned up pretty fast. You know, the Northern Command and the Homeland Security and all these new corruptions of our constitutional order. Makes me wonder whether our legs are already cooked, and that's why they're going ahead and turning it up fast, because it's too late to jump out now.
Well, it's hard to tell. I think people in the government, you know, Americans, most Americans have been so docile for so long that I think a lot of people in the government assume that people are not going to, you know, balk or not going to put their foot down or actively resist no matter what the government does. I think that the government's wrong. I think that people in power underestimate how many Americans will put their foot down and will do what they have to stop the power grabs. But but that's not that many people. So it's important to try to reason with people and keep things peaceful. And it's important to find a way to leash the government, to leash the politicians. And it's important to bring back the rule of law, both for, you know, for average Americans and for federal agents and for American politicians. Because it's outrageous that Bush has told all these lies on taking us to war with Iraq, and the only person on trial is Scooter Libby. There should be so many other people on trial for that, and the same with the torture stuff. The U.S. government has made a big deal out of prosecuting some low-level people in the torture stuff. Why hasn't Rumsfeld, you know, at least been investigated? Wolfowitz, the top people in the White House were involved with this. Gonzalez, the whole idea that Gonzalez would be the attorney general when he was up to his ears in the interrogation torture stuff, I mean, you know, it's hard to maintain faith.
You're right on page 250 of Attention Deficit Democracy. The sin of most political activists today is that they want to be anti-conservative or anti-liberal, anti-Republican or anti-democratic without being anti-Leviathan. But it will take more than changing the names and party affiliations of the people violating the Constitution to revive American liberty. It will take more than denouncing and demonizing opponents to restore the Bill of Rights. So I want to ask you if you think it's possible. Do you think we're even headed in the direction of a new political realignment in America where one or the other of these parties will be forced into the position of the party of Leviathan and the other party take the role of opposition?
I don't see that yet, but, you know, it could be happening, and it's just, it's very possible that I'm simply missing it. It is, you know, I have been encouraged to see how many liberals and Democrats have seemed to have a much clearer understanding of the dangers of government power now. But I was encouraged in the 1990s at how many conservatives and Republicans seemed to understand the danger of government power. So it may just be, to a large degree, a question of opportunism. You know, there is a basic attitude towards government, which Americans had in the early 1800s. I mean, it was an attitude of disdain and contempt, and we need more of that. I mean, it's not necessarily to be hostile to government, and I certainly don't recommend that people waste the time or energy of hating government. But, you know, H.L. Mencken said that the only way a journalist should look at a politician is down. and the same is true in general, most of the time, for the average citizen with any politician. I mean, these folks brag about being public servants. Well, then start acting like it. You know, get in your damn place and stay there.
Well, you'd never know it from listening to this interview, but the book is actually really funny. It's called Attention Deficit Democracy. The author is James Bovard. Thanks very much for your time today, Jim.
Hey, Scott, thanks for the great question. Thanks for the great interview, and it was real fun to be on with you.
All right, everybody, this has been Anti-War Radio for February 1st, 2007. Thanks for listening, and check out the Scott Horton section at LibertyStickers.com.